more of Lake Effect Now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Once upon a time, the group Badfinger was seen as the heirs apparent to the Beatles. And there were good reasons. Two of the group's members were from Liverpool. They were signed to the Beatles' own label, Apple Records. And their first hit song, Come and Get It, was written by none other than Paul McCartney. But as in life, nothing in rock and roll is a certainty. And despite lots of promise and several hits, by the mid-70s, the business end of the music industry had driven a wedge between members Pete Ham, Mike Gibbons, Tom Evans, and Joey Molland. Ham committed suicide in 1975, and Molland had left the group by the 80s when a disastrous effort to reinvigorate the band in Milwaukee led to Evans' suicide as well. With Gibbons dying of natural causes in 2005, Molland is the last of the original Badfinger lineup still around and performing. But since the Badfinger song Baby Blue figured heavily in the finale of the series Breaking Bad, interest in the group has rekindled, and a Joey Molland-led Badfinger will play at Turner Hall this evening. Ahead of that show, he joined us on the line from his home in Minnesota. Thanks so much for being with us.
Well, thank you, Mitch, and thanks for having me.
I'd like to flash back to the early days of Badfinger and ask you, how do you look back on the work that you and the band did with really the members of the Beatles as you were beginning and they were ending?
Well, I remember it fondly. Mostly great times, very exciting times. Of course, a great thrill to be working around the Beatles and stuff. We're all big fans. And you're right, they were in the process of breaking up. When I first met them anyway, the guys were actually with them about a year before I joined. So it was very exciting, really. Was the most predominant feeling, you know.
Do you think of it in terms of gratitude for that relatively, you know, brief period of international stardom? Or do you also think of it in terms of what might have been if the reality of the music business and Apple Records had been different at that place and time?
I don't know if I think about it like that. It was a big thrill to get some success, to be successful. We were just trying to get ourselves together and be as good as we could be. We were very grateful to, you know, George Harrison was really helpful to us, both in the studio and as an example to us of how to, you know, how to be, you know what I mean? In his personality was a very open kind of person and very helpful. He gave himself when he was working with you. He didn't hold anything back. You know, he gave him gave you the benefits of his experience and the knowledge he had, playing the guitar, singing, you know, any kind of musical ideas. He always gave himself completely.
I remember finding out about you. Every day my mind.
They sound like mentors in a way.
Well, they were in a sense, yeah. I think they did like the band and they liked the songs that the band wrote, and which is why they signed us to the label. And I think they wanted to encourage us. You know, and people were starting to say things about the band as well, that the band was good. They liked the music that the band wrote. We wrote all different kinds of music as they did. We'd gone through the same upbringing as they had, you know. Tommy and I grew up in Liverpool. We played the same clubs, listened to the same radio stations, even went to the same music stores. So I think they maybe saw a little bit of themselves in there, maybe, you know.
You played the same clubs as they did coming up, which I would assume means, did you play the Cavern Club?
Oh, sure.
Can you describe what it was like to play the Cavern Club when it was such an influential part of the rock universe?
Small place, I guess, held about 300. It was down in a basement about, I think, three floors down or something. It was always packed. Even the lunchtime sessions were, you know, 50-75% full. It was always a great place to play. A great sound, and how can I describe that? It's, you know, the building it was built in, the cavern was in, was a warehouse, a grain warehouse in downtown Liverpool. And so it was built, 3 foot thick walls and things like that. The sound of the place didn't make any vibrations in the building. You know, it was all compressed and condensed in that room. It was, and the atmosphere, it would get very dense. And now, I've never seen this, but I heard that at that time, you could strike a match down there, and if you moved the match downwards, it would go out. You know, it was so hot and damp down there. Just a great place to play. Everybody wanted to play it, and I had the good fortune of playing it a lot of times. I saw the Beatles there. So the Searchers and a lot of the other Liverpool bands, you know, and I was so impressed when I was a boy, I remember. And I was only about 14, 15 at the time.
I was going to say, you were probably the perfect age at that point and in that place to be a Beatles fan. It must have been something to have seen this group that came from your city turning into what it was turning into in the early 60s.
Oh, yeah, when Love Me Do came out, we were really proud of it, weren't we? I remember seeing it on the jukebox in Capaldi's Cafe in the neighborhood where I lived. And it was really great to see them there. You know, those clubs in those days weren't drinking clubs. So a young guy like me, 14, 15 years old, I could go in there easy. It was a quarter to get in or something. And it was really exciting. It was great. The Cavern was a knockout place, yeah.
Do you think it was those experiences that at places like that made you want to have that life for yourself?
No, actually. I picked up a guitar when I was 11, and I started teaching myself to play, and I enjoyed it. I was aware, we didn't have a TV, but I was aware of, through the radio of people like Elvis and stuff. And my brother had some Buddy Holly records. So I was growing up to play. I never imagined myself being in a band or imagined myself being, you know, a performer or anything. I thought the performers were so great. And that was enforced or reinforced when I started going to clubs and seeing bands. I thought the bands were great. And these players, you know, people like the Beatles, I thought these guys were fantastic musicians, and I would never achieve that kind of musicianship. I simply played for the sheer joy of it, I guess.
Well, so when did it change? What made you make that leap from someone who enjoyed playing it but never thought he was going to go down that road to someone who did?
Well, I happened to get invited to play. I used to, when I was very young, I used to play on the corners. Believe it or not, I used to play on the corner of Penny Lane. In Liverpool, with a friend of mine, a guy named Pete Edge, and some other friends of ours, you know, boys that we knew at the time, remembered that and remembered seeing us playing our Chuck Berry stuff. Well, years go by, I'm working in Liverpool, and I bumped into one of them one day, and a fellow named Pete Wiggins, and he asked me, did I still play the guitar? And I told him I did, and he invited me down to play with his band that night. And I told him I only knew some Chuck Berry and some Buddy Holly songs. I didn't really know much, you know. And he said, well, come down, please come down. And so I did. And I played with them that night. And they gave me a pound, which was about $3. They gave me the pound, and they invited me down the next night. And that was it, really. That was how I got introduced to playing in a band. And after that, I started getting invited to go and play with other people. And as my confidence grew, and you know, I started going out on my own accord and playing with other people. And then eventually I got asked to join another band, and then another band. And then I auditioned for Badfinger somewhere in there, and I got the job.
This is sort of an accidental rock star.
That's right, yeah, yeah. The term rock star always made us feel kind of uncomfortable. you know, Pete and Tommy, Mike, we all had confidence in ourselves and in the band and everything, but we never compared ourselves to the big rock stars, you know?
Well, and I always wonder about that confidence, because you do have to have a certain amount of confidence in yourself to be able to stand on a stage and expect the audience to appreciate what you're playing. And then once you get into the music industry, it must be a constant test of your confidence.
It is, yeah. It is, and you find yourself topping the bill at Carnegie Hall, and you know you're aware of the people who've been there before you, you know, from Ella Fitzgerald on down. You know, it is a thing, and you get very nervous. We did, we'd get very nervous, and it made us really aware of what we were doing and how we can make it better, how we can sound better, what we can do. Some bands at that stage in their career are very fortunate, and they have management people around them who can help them achieve that. Unfortunately for us, we didn't. We were really by ourselves in all of these situations. So we did the best we could. It was a very, very nervy, very nervy thing, you know. But the people were so sweet. They were like our friends. They'd come and see us. They'd talk to us after the shows, and we'd go and talk to the audience as well. We had no friends in America. We didn't know anybody, and it was easy for us to talk to the fans. They were the same as us, you know what I mean?
Yeah, sure.
And so they became our friends, and still are to this day. All over the place, all over America, people are friendly towards us. And I've known them, I've seen them get married and have children and everything. You know, so.
And at the same time, I guess it probably also put you in, given that you're really on your own during this period of stardom, it must have put you in a fairly fragile state to in a position where the rug might be pulled out from under you at any moment.
Exactly, yeah. We really had no experience, no business acumen. We didn't really know what to do, so we were pretty tight at the time. We stayed together. Did a lot of stuff together. It was hard.
There were some, I gather, some pretty dark periods in like the late 70s and early 80s. There were some falling outs that you and your bandmates had, and that couldn't have been a confidence builder either.
That's right, yeah. As the whole situation grew, you know, we were selling a lot of records. We were making a lot of money. We were doing a lot of concerts, probably about 120, 130 concerts a year over that five-year period there. And so we were doing all this work. We were taking a kind of a minimum wage thing, trying to save a bit of money. We were looking for counsel, but we never really got any. We saw the other bands progressing, you know, sound-wise and stage show-wise, you know, doing extra things. We never had any of that stuff. We had a little truck with a PA in it and our drums, you know, and our amps and stuff. And we had a little van. We had a little Mercedes van we'd travel around in, and a couple of roadies, and that was it for us. It was a different world. You know, it was hard. It did lead to frustration in the band. You know, there's a picture of Pete and I listening to a show, and you can see the expressions on our faces as we hear the feedback, and we hear the stuff like that going on that just didn't seem to happen in other people's shows. It was very difficult, and that's just a small example of what it was like. We had a manager who never read contracts. We had another manager who was a business manager, and that's all he was about was contracts. He was the guy who got all the money. We had an accountant, a Wall Street accountant, who had us sign blank tax forms. We don't even know if taxes were filed. It became a nightmare after a while. And then the music business is a bit of a huge kind of family in a sense. And so the people are very caring inside this business. They started to tell us, you know, we'd meet somebody at a party or through a friend, and they'd ask, could they talk to us? And this actually happened to me. a vice president from United Artists asked, could he speak to me? And he took me in a room and he told me that this was in, I guess, 73, early 74. He told me that the band was getting screwed royally, and everybody in the music business knew it, except us. And he identified the people that were doing the screwing, and it turned out to be our business management company. I asked him, of course, right away, would he help us? And he said, well, I'll help the band. I can't help individuals, because you'll just be fighting against you all, like the Beatles have been doing for the past 5 years. So he said, but if you go back to England and talk to the band about it and they decide they want to do something about this, I will represent you, and we'll get you squared away. I went back to England and did talk to the band about it. Peter would not believe it. He was absolutely adamant. Tommy, I think, had an inkling of what was going on through people talking to him, but he'd never raised it. He'd never raised the question in the band. Mike wasn't aware of it, I don't think, so much, but he was aware of it after that, and he came to believe the whole thing, as I said. But Pete was the one that was very stubborn and very adamant, and he absolutely refused to do anything.
And it sounds like it just you could see the knots between you starting to fray and things start to come apart.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, because in a band, you know, there's a time in a band where they're the only people that you do believe, you know, that you do trust are the people in the band with you. And that's just a band relationship that happens kind of naturally. They were the first signs that the band was cracking and stopping being a band, if you like. Yes.
Do you have any regrets about how it ended that way?
I do. Some should have stayed. And maintained my argument a bit longer. But it was really frustrating, and Peter was so adamant. It just seemed like a hopeless situation to me, so I did leave, you know. I wish it had ended differently, of course, but there wasn't really anything I could do, you know. So.
You have been doing solo work now for a while as well. You perform as Joey Molland's Badfinger, but you have some albums out that are purely branded as Joey Molland. And I know the most recent one is really influenced by Memphis, right?
Yeah. You know, I've always loved Memphis and the music from there. I've done the Sun Studios thing, and I've been Elvis's house a few times, and I just loved the atmosphere of the city and everything. And I had occasion to go there and do a session for a friend of mine. I play some guitar. And while I was there, we did the session at Royal Studios, Willie Mitchell's place. Willie is, of course, a great old producer. Al Green and people like this, and a lot of the great blues artists, B.B. King. Anyway, so I was playing in the studio, and I fell in love with it. And I had a budget for an album, a small budget, and I was able to talk Carl. He was producing the session I was doing, Carl Wise, and I had the opportunity to talk to him about making a record there, and he agreed to produce and set the whole thing up, and I told him my budget, and he was able to come in with it pretty close, and so we went down there and did it.
Maybe a wise man searching for truth. You might hear things, you might have the blues. Still gotta walk out in the rain. You might find.
So when you're doing a concert and you have this new material, but you have probably most of the concert goers there to hear these classics that they associate you with. How do you strike that balance and give the audience what they want to hear without compromising the stuff you've been working on more recently?
I've always kept my new material out of the shows, out of the Badfinger shows, because I do know that people, when they see, Badfinger or Joey Molland's Badfinger, they come to the show, they expect to hear, of course, all the hits and a bunch of the Bad Finger material, and that is predominantly what I play on the show. I think that's why people come and see the Bad Finger show, because they do get what they want. It doesn't bother me to pay to play Baby Blue.
Do you think you're going to have more people showing up at the concert who are just recently aware of Bad Finger thanks to its appearance on that last episode of Breaking Bad?
Yeah, we are getting some more, actually. We're selling out a lot more shows since that happened. And we've always had a good mixed age group, you know, for our audience. I don't know. It's happy. It's happy for me to play. You know, it's great to see young guys out there, young people come and see us, and they come to the meet and greets and they say, we just heard it. I get emails. And I think they like it. They relate to something in the music. And I think it's the same thing that people always related to in it. You know, it's just, it's very straight ahead music. It's very honest. And they like it. You know, I'm proud of that. You know, we do No Matter What today as good as anybody ever did it anywhere. The performances bring the songs to life, and I've always stressed that with the band. We must bring this music to life. Not enough to just go play it, you know?
It is terrific that you are able to still do that after all these years. And Joy Molland, it has been a delight. Thank you so much for spending so much time with us.
Well, thank you, Mitch, and thanks for your interest, and thanks for talking about my new record.
Joey Molland is the last remaining original member of the group Bad Finger, which will play a show tonight at Turner Hall Ballroom. You can hear more of our conversation at wuwm.com/Lake Effect. That's all for the Friday edition of Lake Effect. We are produced, as we always are, by Dan Harmon, Stephanie Lecce, and Bonnie North. We get production assistance from Eleanor Peterson and Craig Wirrell, web assistance from Michelle Matternowski, and studio engineering from John Stralecki. I'm Mitch Tyke. Hope you have a great weekend. Hope we can be a part of it. Lake Effect Weekend airs Saturday and Sunday afternoon at 3 on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Keep listening. Fresh air is next. It's 11 o'clock.